Well, hello and welcome to the No Filter Needed podcast, where we cut the fluff, expel those myths, and kick unobtainable standards to the curb. I am your host, Camilla Collins, self-image consultant, author, and founder of multiple beauty and creative entertainment agencies. I am super passionate about empowering people to change their self-perception and reimagine not just the beauty, but the huge amount of power within themselves. And this podcast is in support of my mission to do just that. So hello and welcome back to the hashtag No Filter Needed podcast. And today I am joined by the very lovely Matt Haycox, who is an entrepreneur, investor, funding expert and mentor. Now, Matt has been building and growing businesses for both himself and his clients for more than 20 years. He's been there many times over and got the t-shirts with a lot of things, and his overall strategies and advice are honest, tangible and grounded in reality. Hurrah. His business career started in 1999 when he was thrown in at the deep end to save a fading corporate clothing business. And he's been on one heck of a journey and has quite the story to tell. So I'm not going to spoil too much by way of introduction. Let's hear it all from the man himself. Matt, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Camilla. I feel I've got a lot to live up to with that introduction
now. Well, it's all you. And, you know, I've been following you for a while. And we met virtually at the beginning of the pandemic last year in the similar situation to this. And, yeah, I just really wanted to get you on the show. And I've listened to a lot of your YouTube stuff as well and heard parts of your journey. And it's really inspiring. And I'm really intrigued with, you know, your whole attitude and mindset towards things. And you've done so much. So I just feel like you can share so much with everyone listening.
No problem. Pleasure. Love to be here.
Awesome. So could we start sort of at the beginning? Could you take us through your sort of journey, how it all began with the clothing business? And I know you've had lap dancing clubs, you've run pubs, you've had coffee bars, a lot in the business world, and you're very spontaneous, and you've lived in, well, you're currently in Dubai now, and you've lived in Vegas and all these places. So talk us through it. Where did it all begin?
Well, my interest in business goes back probably 30 years now. It's funny, it's like forever ago, but I can remember it like it was yesterday. And I came from a business related family. My dad owned his own business. I mean, he was first generation business owner. He came from a background, you know, council estate, you know, poor demographic background. First guy in his family to go to university, left Rotherham and moved to Leeds. And he started what was, by the time I was probably 8, 9, 10 years old, a reasonably successful IT business, which ultimately became very successful. And I guess that must have been what spurred my interest in business. And I remember being, you know, 10, 11, 12 years old, you know, lying in bed at night, you know, reading every business book I could get my hands on, which, you know, for me was normally biographies. I like biographies, like autobiographies, because I guess I liked to listen to the real world problem solving that these people have been through. So, you know, from back then, I always knew that I wanted to be in business. I didn't know what I wanted to do, but I guess I knew I wanted to make a load of money, and I felt that business was the way it was going to happen for me. And I guess, you know, for me, it's kind of an interesting point, because, you know, I think that nowadays, when you talk to a lot of successful people, you know, a lot of entrepreneurs, that they're the first generation entrepreneurs in their family, and they, you know, they kind of come from a background of, where they struggled for money, or you know, where they, you know, didn't get the education they wanted, or the love, or whatever that may have been as a kid. And I can't tick any of those boxes. You know, I came from a well off middle class family. You know, from a dad who was a successful business owner. But I think, you know, for me, I guess I probably got more hunger from the success that he'd had. And you know, whilst I guess you look at a lot of, you know, sons and daughters of successful or wealthy people, and they probably had it on a plate and were very, very lazy. You know, whilst I very much respected my dad's success, I wanted much more than that for myself. So I guess it was a nice starting block for me, but I would not consider it a disadvantage, or actually I wouldn't consider it an advantage or disadvantage. I mean, if I had to pick one or the other, obviously I came from a fantastic childhood, but for me, I was always very determined to make my own way in that journey. Whereas my mum, on the other hand, you know, was very pro-education. You know, we're talking about, you know, mid-90s here, when, you know, if you didn't wear a suit and you didn't have a degree, to most of the world, you probably didn't have that, the credentials of success. And my mum was adamant that because she hadn't been to university, I was going to be a doctor or a lawyer or something to make the family proud. But I was determined to go and make my way in business. And when I finished school, obviously at 18, I'd done my A levels. And for me, I was ready to then finish and go and make my way in business, whatever that may be. My mum was adamant that I was going to uni, so the kind of family compromise was that I was going to effectively have a gap year. You know, all my friends were having gap years anyway, so that they'd be travelling or doing whatever they were doing. So my gap year was going to be working down the markets and trying to start a mail order business or whatever the latest fad or craze I'd just been reading up on at the time was. And that was 1998 for me. I left school, and around the same time, my father had actually sold his business and had started to invest in some other companies. And he had invested in a business, as you mentioned earlier, that made uniforms, made corporate clothing for security guards and bus drivers and nurses, etc. And there was an opportunity for me to get involved there, to work in sales, to learn from the kind of shop floor up. And that's what I did. And I started in that business, and it was a family-owned business at the time. Not my family, another family had owned it for two or three generations. And I guess it's, now I'm probably much more experienced in this side of things. It's what I would describe as your typical generational family business. It was just full of excess and inefficiency and politics and waffle. I was kind of stuck in amongst the middle of all this. I was just, this hungry 18-year-old who was, both with my own hat on, gagging to progress, and then also, I guess, with my dad's hat on, wanting to make sure that the best happened for his investment. And I used to go home night after night, because I was still living at home at the time. So I used to go home, banging on the kitchen table at dinner saying, "This is ridiculous. This business is going down the pan. Everyone's taking the piss out of you. They're wasting your money." And my dad kind of used to say, "Look, I agree with you, but I'm kind of tired. I've had 30 years in business, and now is almost my rest time. And whilst I agree with you, I can't really be bothered doing anything about it." And I guess this frustrated me even more and more. And then one day I came home, and I think he was probably just sick of me bleating on at the dinner table. He said, "You know what? Whatever." He goes, "You can't make a worse job of it than the guys who are in there already. So you could, you can run it. Go make whatever decisions you want to make." So I woke up the next morning, went in, and I felt the only decision that could be made was for me to fire everybody. and literally, that's what I did. Other than one little guy in the warehouse, it must have been 60, 65 years old, this fellow who'd been there for about 30 years, I kept him. But other than him, got rid of everybody and started from absolute scratch in the business, redefining the product, redefining the customer base, the marketing plan, supply chain, started everything from scratch. And long story short, I feel like I've been talking for hours.
It's a great story, so keep going.
it's a good job I can see your face on this, and I thought you'd have nodded off. So over the next two or three years, I really had the best, let's say, playground to cut my teeth in that any, you know, aspiring business owner could possibly ask for. And it's funny, I say that because I want to learn and I want to, you know, I want to fix problems. Most of the people probably have looked at it and said it was the worst possible situation you could have been in. But I was looking at a business that had no customers, that had no customers that wanted to deal with us anymore anyway. It had no suppliers that wanted to deal with us because they hadn't been paid. You know, the bank wanted rid of us. The operational setup in the office was a disaster as well. But I guess I had every opportunity, you know, to learn from problems and fix it, you know, fix this situation. So for me, the next 2.5 years was taking that business that was losing about £300,000 a year when I started to booking a profit of about £35,000-£40,000, 2.5-3 years later. And whilst, you know, in today's world, it might not sound like, you know, astronomical or particularly exciting sums, you know, for me, it wasn't really the money that I benefited from there. You know, it was that learning ground, you know, to be able to experience everything that could possibly go wrong in business and experience it while I was kind of 18, 19, 20 years old. Because I very much talk about nowadays, you know, the fact that you only really learn anything from your mistakes. And you know, whether it's your mistakes or somebody else's mistakes, you know, you can only learn things, you know, from mistakes or from problems. And you know, I think a lot of the reason why people have stress and let's say insecurities in business nowadays is when you have a business problem, you know, hopefully you should only be experiencing it once, or certainly not experiencing it multiple times. So normally people kind of go along in the day-to-day life, you know, running that business, and then a big problem occurs and they don't know how to deal with the problem, they don't know who to ask for advice, and then it's like the world's kind of coming down on them. And I guess, you know, maybe an analogy of that would be like, you know, you can do your driving lessons, you know, you can drive a car all day long, you might be driving for 15 years, but until an articulated lorry falls over in the middle of three lanes on a motorway, or until the car next to you blows up, you've never been in that situation to be able to know how you're going to react to the pressure and to know how you're going to get out of that situation. I think for me, that's very much what it's like. You're like in business, but I had every problem that you could possibly ask for, you know, at the ages of kind of 18, 19, 20 years old. So when I left that business back in 2001, 2002, when I was about 21, and I left because really, I think for me, it no longer suited my interests and personality insofar as I like being entrepreneurial. I like setting something up. I like having ideas and trying to see them through to fruition. But I'm not a great steady hand. You know, I'm not probably a very good manager of people and captain of a steady ship. And for me, that's what the business then needed at that point. You know, the fires have been fought and put out, and there was a framework in place. And I was probably not the best person to take it forward, nor did they really have the interest to take it forward. So I stepped away. My dad came back in at that point, and I went off to start the kind of next journey in my life, which was in the leisure industry. Because, you know, at 20, 22 years old, every guy wants to drink beer and chase girls, and I decided that qualified me to be a bar owner and a nightclub operator, and that's where I then went to when I was about 21, 22.
And so then it stops at that age, does it? So we'll just carry on.
No, I was going to say I can carry on. I didn't get any questions from me. But yeah, so basically from then I started in leisure, opened one or two pubs to varying degrees of unsuccess, as I would always say. And I realised that the reason the pubs weren't working for me was that the only income stream we had back then was from selling beer. And I felt it was too hard a business to not have some other kind of ancillary income, you know, whether that was from food or from door entry fees or from promotion fees, whatever it may be. I wanted to have some other income other than beer. And again, as a 23, 22, 23-year-old who went out every night and may have accidentally ended up in a lap dancing club more than one too many times. I deemed that also qualified me to know everything about the lap dancing industry, which I could then marry with my beer sales and have the perfect business model, both financially and socially, to fulfil every 23-year-old's dream. And I opened my first lap dancing club in March 2004. I remember it like it was yesterday. In a place called Cheapside in Wakefield. I'm not going to put it all down to luck, because I had a strategy and a business model that I felt was going to work, but it was also very good timing for me. I think, you know, back in 2004, lap dancing as a business was becoming, let's say, probably more socially acceptable than it had been over the previous 2, 3, 4 years. It was making the press. You know, you had mainstream brands like Stringfellows or Spearmint Rhino who were bringing this into the more mainstream acceptability. And I think that, coupled with the fact that, you know, I'd always had the ethos that we were going to run this like a proper business, as opposed to, again, you know, the stereotype of lap dancing bars back then was that they were either, you know, drug dealers, money laundering tools, or rich man's playthings. And mine was obviously going to be neither. It was going to be a legitimate business with legitimate business principles. Just in a potentially out of favour sector. And we hit the ground running in March 2004. And over the next 4 or 5 years, ultimately ended up becoming the biggest lap dancing operator in the UK. It had 11 trading venues from Blackpool down to Bristol. We had a venue in Birmingham, which was the biggest club in Europe and the second biggest club in the world. And during all of that time, I'd been introduced to bank finance, to alternative finance, to all kinds of different ways to fund businesses that I'd never known of or experienced before. And I used that easy availability of cash. And I say easy availability of cash because, again, we're talking 2004, 5, 6, 7, you know, well, before the credit crunch, when, you know, banks and lenders were dishing out money like sweets. And, I used that to build a lap dancing chain, to build a chain of non-lap dancing bars and pubs. You know, I opened retail shops. I started my own finance company. And everything couldn't have gone better until come on June 2008, onset of the credit crunch. I was completely over-leveraged, and we talked earlier about the fact that, you know, you hit these big problems in business, and until you've dealt with them once, you never really know how to deal with them. And for me, that was, you know, an unsurmountable problem. I was 28 years old, 27, 28. I had about £45 million of debt and personal guarantees across these businesses. And probably 100 lenders have provided that for me. And at that particular point, about 50 of them turned around saying, well, you know, we're not giving you any more, and we want our money back as well. It was an unfixable, unsurmountable problem. Our businesses were put into bankruptcy in kind of August 2008. And by September 2008, I was made personally bankrupt, which, you know, if you'd have gone back 90 days, 100 days, it couldn't have been a more different picture to the life I was living. Nor at that point either could I possibly have envisaged that situation was going to occur. I had a one-year-old daughter at the time, one maybe two-year-old daughter at the time. Like I say, 2 or 3 months before, flying around the world, houses around the world, cars, friends, you know, spending money like it was going out of fashion, and then waking up the next day, and realizing it's all ended, and what do I do next? After you, go on, say again.
The from one extreme to the other, just hearing the amount of money as well. I mean, can I just ask? I'm noting there's lots of things I'm going to go back to, but maybe we'll just work backwards from here. Is Can I ask, like, what is the feeling? Because I, you know, even just hearing you, trying to imagine myself being in that position, like, it literally would feel like the entire world was crumbling, like, away from me. The ground beneath my feet was going. What was the feeling when you realized you were so far in it that there was nothing you could do? You couldn't get yourself out of it.
I mean, I think there's probably multiple, you know, very amplified feelings, you know, to talk about that all happened over this period of a few months. And I think if you talk, I think the biggest feeling, or not, let's say feeling, situation initially is delusion. And this is something, you know, this is something I'll always talk about, you know, with businesses that I'm advising or business areas that are struggling nowadays, because I think the biggest problem I had is if you go back to June, July of 2008, 2 or 3 months before we got under, if you'd asked me then, I would have thought that I had a 101% chance of finding solutions to get out of the problem. If I now look at it, you know, knowing what I know now, the reality is the writing was on the wall probably 12 months prior. And the problems to do with the finances of those businesses were insurmountable long before they ever became an issue. So, first of all, there was that kind of feeling of delusion, or rather, let's say, experience of delusion, followed by probably disbelief on my end. Because, like I say, you know, you never really know right up until the last minute which way things are going to go. You know, are we going to keep the lenders on board? Are we not? Are we going to be able to raise money? Are we not? And you know, I've always been an optimistic person, and like I said, I think that optimism, coupled with the delusion of not wanting to accept, you know, what was going wrong, probably meant that I didn't really even realise anything up until the last couple of days, if not the actual last day, when things really, really went wrong. And then I guess, you know, the next feeling is, you know, waking up that next day when your assets that were once yours yesterday are not yours anymore. You know, your credit cards don't work, your bank account's been locked. And where do you go from there? And I guess my answer is, like, you know, I've got to say that I'm fortunate again that I'm a very positive, you know, I'm very positive in these situations. But I very much looked at this as that I can sit here and cry and moan. And again, all the people around me, you know, the advisor, I'm going to say friends, but let's say advisors, have said to me that my life and career was very much over. That, you know, you're 28 years old, you're an absolutely spectacular bankrupt with an irrecoverably tarnished reputation. You've got no chance of working a business again. You'll never borrow money again. Basically your life's over. But I guess whilst I didn't know what I was going to do, I also knew that I could never accept those words. You know, and now, you know, whether it was because I had a 2-year-old who needed feeding, or a wife that I was with, or the fact that, you know, I didn't want myself to be poor. You know, and I always think I would enjoy life more with money than without it. I knew that wasn't going to be the end. And I very much kind of, you know, got up the next day, and kind of got back on the horse and decided, well, you know, first things first, I need to start bringing some money in again. Then the next step, you know, what businesses can I start or build or rebuild? Because, you know, I mean, I've kind of said it multiple times before, but, you know, I could lie on the couch feeling sorry for myself, you know, watching Jeremy Kyle all day, but it's not going to pay the bills. You know, it may sound an oversimplification, but that kind of very much is how I feel about all negative situations, you know, whether it's, you know, business failures, you know, relationship breakups, you know, accidents, disasters, you know, whatever it may be. You know, we can moan about it, we can talk about it, etc. But the only real thing I want to talk about in any of these situations is to learn from it so it doesn't happen again. Other than that, you know, sitting and wallowing in self-pity is not going to, you know, make a success of something. It's not going to pay the bills. It's not going to pay my daughter's school fees, and it's just not for me.
Absolutely. And yeah, it's focusing on the solution and not the problem, because that's not going to get anyone anywhere, and solution-based thinking, but just like the mental resilience as well, and to, you know, the pressure, I can't even imagine, obviously with such a young baby, and obviously a family to support. And did you have, I mean, where do you think this kind of mental resilience that you have kind of has come from, and this switching to the positive thinking? Was it something that you developed over time? Do you think it was something that was kind of instilled in you in childhood, maybe through your father or through your upbringing or the people around you?
You know, it's nothing that was ever spoken about as a child. I mean, I guess, you know, it has to have come from, you know, from my surroundings as a kid, you know, from my parents, probably particularly my father in some way, shape or form. But I mean, I kind of come from a generation where these things were talked about a lot less than they are nowadays. You know, I mean, we very much live in a, let's say that Instagram world now of preaching this and teaching the other, and you know that's probably another conversation itself, you know, as to how much veracity there is, you know, behind a lot of the people doing that preaching. But, you know, rightly or wrongly, you know, it's very much something that's taught and trained and openly discussed. You know, back in the kind of, you know, mid 80s, early 90s, you know, when I was a kid, and, you know, my more formative years, it was never something that was really spoken about. I mean, I was always, you know, pushed along by my parents, you know, that they'd want the best for me. They'd, you know, they'd try and motivate me to do better in my exams or better at sports day or whatever it may be. I guess it's just always been in my makeup. That I want that success, and that ultimately, you know, by not pushing forward for it, you know, the only person I'm really letting down is myself.
Yeah, is that nature versus nurture argument back again? I think.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, look, nature has to have its part. It has to have its part in everything, I guess, doesn't it? But, you know, I'm a lot more for nurture than nature. But like I say, I've got to give the credit, you know, for most of my character traits, you know, to my parents. But it was just a much less talked about world than I think it is today.
Yeah, and I really resonate with some of the stuff you were saying in terms of your background. You're not from a poor background, but you're still driven. I guess that entrepreneurial spirit that was there from childhood and being a kid, I think I've mentioned this before on the podcast, but, you know, when I can't remember how old, I must have been like 8 or 9 maybe, going up to Paris. I think the Eurostar wasn't long open. And I just took it upon myself to go around collecting rubbish and collecting money and getting paid to do it. And it's just thinking up things more out of boredom, or just trying to, you know, find things to do that will make money. I remember going to school and selling stuff from home. And it's just that wiring, I think, of ways of thinking. But my dad's very much, he works himself. He's an electrician, his side of the family as well. They all have their own businesses. My brother has his own gym. My sister had she does bridal accessories, and she now does upcycles stuff as well. Whereas my mum's side is kind of different. And she, you know, she was pushing me off to secretarial college after art school. And I was like, I'm not going. I'd sooner get in a company and work my way up than waste my time kind of studying. I just wanted to be hands-on and kind of progressing and doing stuff. And I just think I've always had that from an early age. And it sounds like you have as well. And you had this perfect opportunity with this clothing business and a bit of connection there, but to get in and just really practice firsthand. And I can't imagine at the age of 18, 19, going, managing this whole business and turning it around. What was that like for you when you were that age, having this huge responsibility?
I mean, I guess looking back now, I must have made mistake after mistake. I guess it was something that I felt I'd always been, you know, I'd always been training all my life to be ready for it. From, like, you know, like a, from 10, 11, 12 years old, you know, reading business books, you know, studying other successful business people, you know, reading management theories. I mean, you know, my A-levels at school were business studies and accountancy. You know, I'd always had a very good grounding in and understanding of the numbers, you know, which, again, you know, 20 years on now is something that I'll talk about very regularly, that I think far too many, if not almost, you know, the majority of business owners don't have anything like a good enough grasp on the finances of their business. And, you know, as a lender now, you know, when I go to businesses, you know, to ask them questions about their accounts or about the economics of their business model, the answer I'll get time and time again is, I don't deal with that. I've got an accountant, I've got an FD. You know, I'll refer you to him. And I'm not saying for 1 minute that you know, that every chief exec of a business can be an absolute expert in accounts, can be an absolute expert in marketing or operations or whatever it may be. But I think to be successful in business, you really have to have a good enough grounding in all of those disciplines to be able to add value and know that you're not getting the wool pulled over your eyes by the people that are running those departments. So I guess, you know, kind of, you know, going back to, you know, that corporate clothing business, whilst I was very, very green, if you like, in running the business, I probably felt I had enough grounding in each of the different disciplines within the business to know that the people who were running it before me were having our pants down or certainly trying to pull the wool over our eyes, and therefore knew enough to go and recruit the right people into the right positions. And I think, you know, and even to this day, that's still very much my, you know, my business strategy on the companies that I, you know, that I try to grow or that I invest in. And that, you know, I know my skill sets, but I also know my shortcomings, and, you know, I just, you know, love to surround myself by people who are infinitely more talented than me in the areas that I am not too good at.
You're so right, and let's talk about that. The, like, you know, your support network, your contacts, like the importance of having that. I just, as part of your environment, there's a saying, like, you're the average of the five people you spend the most time with or whatever. But I mean, it's true, isn't it? You know, the more, and also you mentioned about autobiographies and biographies, which it's amazing, because when we read things like that, or, you know, we watch stuff like that, we can actually, it's tangible and real to us, as opposed to learning a program or doing a kind of a course and someone just speaking it. When someone's lived it, you can visualize that. And that really helps you, I think, to put it into practice in your own life. But I think your support network and the people that you spend time with are just so important, perhaps the most important thing in terms of proof of you progressing in life and learning and being encouraged to do more things. How do you feel about that?
Yeah, I mean, you know, mentorship's something that's been very important to me. I'm going to say all my life, but, you know, something that I've really strived to understand more and develop more over the last kind of 5, 6, 7 years. Because I think, again, you know, going back, you know, 20 years, 25 years, it was probably uncool to admit where you didn't know things. And I think for me, that's always been one of the problems with business. You know, when you talk about the progression of business owners and business leaders, that, you know, that when you're a sports person, it's completely normal to have coaches, to have support teams around you. And if you were, you know, if you're playing tennis, for example, if you've just picked up a tennis racket and hit two or three balls for the first time, you would never possibly think of putting yourself in the same league as Roger Federer. I mean, you wouldn't even think of putting yourself in the same league as the guy at the local club who's been playing for 3 or 4 years. Because there's very, let's say, clear divisions of experience and skill set. But when we talk about business, you know, it's perceived as binary, that, you know, you're either a business owner or you're not. And almost, you know, by this incorrect definition, the first day you start in business, you're a business owner, you know, pitching yourself against, you know, Alan Sugar or someone else who's, you know, uber successful, 40 years in the business. And then it kind of brings, whether it's delusion or arrogance or insecurity, whatever, you know, to admit to your problems. You know, you can be a 3, 4, 5 year old, someone who's been in business for 3, 4, 5 years, who's, like I say, not really experienced much, because until you've experienced the problems in business, everything's been plain sailing. And really, you know, not know what you don't know what you don't know. So I guess, yes, I had mentors back in the day, because they were people I looked up to, or people whose brains I may have picked, but I certainly didn't understand the concept of mentorship back then. And like I say, you know, looking back then, I would have imagined it would be almost something to be ashamed or embarrassed of, you know, admitting that, you know, you're going to this person for advice or support or help. Whereas now, you know, it's something I couldn't, you know, advocate and preach for enough. That, you know, yeah, I've got great mentors around me. You know, whether we use the word mentor, coach, advisor, support, whatever, you know, this or much of the same thing. Now, I've got people who are maybe informal mentors, you know, people who are just good friends who I can pick up the phone to for a chin wag, or, you know, pick the brains on a problem over a bottle of wine, through to having, you know, specific experts in particular fields. Whereas, take social media, for example, you know, I'll have my, you know, social media mentor, who is, you know, a guy who's, you know, physically on a paid retainer, who will assist me and assist other people within the business. And I've got that for, you know, for many different disciplines and different areas of the businesses that I work in. And for me, there is no other way. And I think anyone who doesn't think in that way is, you know, at best doing themselves a disservice, and, you know, really more realistically just being stupid and arrogant and completely hindering the progress.
Yeah, I totally agree. And, you know, I struggled to ask for help, you know, early on as well. And I guess it's kind of seen as a weakness as well, but it's just, you're going to waste time. And I did waste a lot of time trying to do stuff probably longer than I should, before asking for help or potentially outsourcing it. But then again, it's striking that balance of what we were saying earlier of, you know, doing a little bit of everything so you know how stuff works, so no one's going to screw you over, pull the wool over your eyes, but then also knowing when to get someone else to kind of help you with it, or delegate or outsource those things. So it's just that kind of fine line. But I think, yeah, you know, having your, not just your business and your personal kind of social friend groups, is kind of merging those two together, which I assume you've got down to an absolute T, and all's kind of mingled perfectly. But it's so important to have those people around us with the know-how that can elevate us and introduce us to new people, I feel, into
100%. Yeah, I mean, like I was saying, you know, until you've dealt with the problems, you know, you don't know what the solutions are, and even if you have dealt with the problems a couple of times, you know, you won't have dealt with them as many times as someone who's done it, you know, day in, day out, you know, week in, week out for many years. So yeah, that's a massive part of I guess my ongoing development, and, you know, what I see is my business success. And you mentioned meeting new people as well, and, you know, something I, you know, anyone who knows me or anyone who follows me on social will know that I preach about, you know, the power of networking, the power of my network on an almost daily basis. And, you know, I'll put pretty much all of my success down, or not all of my success, but all of my say key money making moments over the years, I've always been to do with great relationships, you know, with certain people, you know, whether that's partnerships, or, you know, or someone who's funded something for me, or someone who's introduced me to an opportunity that I otherwise wouldn't have known about. You know, all of these things have come from having a great network, and, you know, and it's something that, even to today, and, you know, I'm sure hopefully until the day I die, always be looking to, you know, to meet new people, you know, to expand my network. And, you know, I very much, you know, pride myself on having, you know, a, phone book of, you know, great friends through to acquaintances through to just professional people that I can pick the phone up to, you know, in every kind of conceivable area, or being able to get to, you know, to this person through that person, you know, without having to be, you know, 7 degrees of separation. I'd like to think it's probably no more than 1 or 2 degrees of separation to, you know, kind of be able to pick up the phone to pretty much anyone I want to be able to. And that, look, you know, I've been doing this for 25 years developing these relationships, so, you know, I'm not saying that someone else can do it overnight, but it will take time, it will take effort. But, you know, I think for me, one of the biggest differences anyone can make to their business success and to the enjoyment of their life as well is to really, you know, double down on building a powerful network.
I love that. And it's so much more enjoyable to share the journey as well, like all the journey, and not have to, yeah, for it to all kind of flow together and just share it with other people, the successes and just progress all together. So I love it. I love that. It's been really amazing chatting to you about all of this. It's been absolutely brilliant. I just wondered one quick question, or maybe two. Just because, you know, after the crazy ness that we are in and the last year that we had, you know, what advice on a, you know, even on a mindset level, on a mental health level, would you give to people having, you know, been through what you have with a bankruptcy yourself, to anyone that's, you know, really struggling at the moment, has lost their business or their job, you know, potentially even thinking of starting up their own thing? What kind of advice would you give to people right now who are feeling the fear and have experienced loss?
Well, I think some of the kind of key principles we've talked about over the last 45 minutes or so, you know, probably very much feature in my answer here. In that, I mean, one of the things I never really got into, but I guess one of the reasons that I don't particularly feel fear at at failure in business, you know, but probably one of the reasons in hindsight why I didn't feel great fear over the bankruptcy, and why when I've had more severe business situations over the years since then, is because ultimately I've got belief in myself and certain skill sets I've got to be able to, you know, to be able to earn money. And that doesn't mean it's going to be a smooth road. That doesn't mean I'm going to be able to fix a situation overnight. But I know that if, you know, you take everything from me today and, you know, plonk me in the middle of nowhere, I've got skill sets in marketing, in sales, in business development, in deal structuring that will ultimately start earning me money again in hopefully a relatively short space of time. And I think, you know, one of the biggest things that we, you know, we all really need to have learnt in, you know, over the last 12 months of the pandemic, and have been either made redundant or being furloughed or losing our businesses, etc., is to do as much as possible to not have to rely on other people. And you know, what skill sets can you develop for yourself that will get you paid in your time of need? And, you know, this is something I've actually not spoken about this for a while, but, you know, in the early parts of March, April, May last year, you know, this is something I kind of found myself talking about time and time again. And look, you know, there's always going to be relativity in people's needs and money. And I'm not saying for 1 minute that you can go and develop a skill set that's going to make you millions if that's not your particular forte, particular area. But everybody has got skills. Even if you don't, you know, everybody's got the ability to monetize those skills in some way, shape, or form. Even if you don't think you have, you know, the person who's done A-level French is 6 years ahead of the 12-year-old who's struggling with their, you know, with their French right now, and you could be a tutor for them. You know, the person who's got an interest in flower arranging or who's a hobbyist magician or whatever, you know, can find ways to monetize those skills. And obviously, one of people's biggest fears over the last 12 months is, you know, paying the rent and putting food on the table. I'm not saying necessarily that these things are going to make millionaires, but, you know, we all either should already have a skill set or should be able to relatively easily develop and find skill sets that, you know, that can pay the rent, that can feed the kids, and that can put some petrol in the car. And I think, you know, so that's something that's, you know, ultimately very, very important. essential, really. And like I say, the reason I've never felt probably too much fear is because I've always had a belief in myself and my own abilities. I think the other thing I'd say as well is I think, you know, most of the probably the sadness, the depression, etc., you know, that comes in these situations comes from worrying about what other people think of us. I'm probably more fortunate than most in that I genuinely don't give a shit what other people think. But I think, you know, if you can develop that gene or develop that skill set, to be able to not worry, because ultimately, that's what causes stress. You know, if you drove a Bentley yesterday and you get stuck in a Kia tomorrow, you're probably not getting stressed because you really hate the Kia that much more than you do the Bentley. You're getting stressed because you're thinking about all the people who saw you yesterday in the Bentley and you're embarrassed about them seeing you in the Kia today. And you know, when you look at it like that, the problem is with you, and the problem is very solvable by you. And I think I've probably gone around the houses with in the answer for you. But I think if people can take something from both of those two answers and dig deeper on them, then that, you know, that should set you in a semi profitable and mentally stable state for years to come.
I love that, and that's such a great point. All of it, but you know, particularly that last bit, absolutely, that is just the root cause of all the self-doubt and the, you know, fearful feelings, is worrying, you know, worrying what other people think. And social media as well gives a massive platform for that, especially when looking at other people's lives and all their perfectly cropped images and their highlights reels, and it's really easy to get sucked into it. That's the one kind of element I've quite enjoyed, staying at home more of the last kind of year, and just being in myself and building my confidence in myself, just not having to kind of be. It's human nature, it's human instinct, isn't it, to kind of not people please necessarily, but kind of adapt and be part of the pack, really. So you do kind of change yourself a little bit when you're out and about and around. So I think we've had a great amount of time sitting at home on our own, to really kind of reconnect with us. And I guess the homework there for everybody is to really look within and find that skill set you were talking about, and the things that you're great at and the value that you can give, and then, you know, really kind of honing in on that and packaging it up for something new potentially. So love it. Thank you so much.
Thanks a lot for having me. Been a pleasure.
Absolutely wonderful. Enjoy the rest of your time in Dubai. We look forward to having you back one day in the UK for a little
bit. I'll be there. Thanks, Camilla.
All right. Thanks so much, Matt. Bye.
Bye.
Thank you so much for listening. I hope you got some good takeaways from today. And if so, then please do leave a review. Make sure you subscribe so you don't miss an episode, and you can find further insights and tools over at camillacollins.com.